May it please the court, my name is Doug Meyer, registration number 19883. With me today is my co-counsel, Ann Gill, 914-610. Together we represent the appellant, David Carrillo. I intend this afternoon to briefly highlight five areas. The other arguments, we stand on our briefs. Number one, the scant and the conflicting testimony that convicted David Carrillo of first-degree murder. Two, the fact that David Carrillo was required to stand trial with the co-defendant who was also an alleged victim, a problem that was created by the prosecution. Three, trial counsel's failure to seek the lesser non-included offense of accessory to a crime. Four, trial counsel's failure to explain the theory of complicity when the plea offer was conveyed. And five, post-conviction counsel's conflict. So what was the evidence that convicted David Carrillo of murder? The evidence in its entirety was the testimony of two teenage co-conspirators, primarily the testimony of Jason Uriosity, a 14-year-old, who in exchange for his testimony received no time served. Secondarily, it was the testimony of a 17-year-old co-conspirator, Dee Herrera, who received immunity in exchange for his testimony. What did these two highly motivated witnesses testify to that warranted a first-degree murder conviction, keeping in mind that the self-confessed shooter had already pled to second-degree murder and is currently eligible for parole as we make these arguments today? What exactly did David Carrillo do according to these two witnesses? According to them, he did three things. Number one, David Carrillo gave a dark jacket to his brother on a cold night. Number two, David Carrillo told everyone where to stand while his brother and Montoya, another defendant, split off from the group. And three, that David Carrillo had hatched some far-fetched plan to escape to Mexico, robbing banks along the way. Keeping in mind, David Carrillo is not from Mexico, he's from Colorado. That is the totality of the evidence which supported the theory of complicity. And perhaps most importantly, on those three items, how many of those did the two witnesses agree on? None. On each and every one of those three items, both witnesses' testimony conflicted with each other. The first issue I'd like to bring up was not addressed by the district court, even though it was thoroughly briefed. And it's an argument that is probably very unique to this case, and that is the fact that David Carrillo was required to stand trial with a co-defendant who was also an alleged victim in the case. The co-defendant, Mr. Montoya, was the subject of the charge for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. This issue permeates the entire case, every issue in the case from start to finish. It's the lack of fundamental fairness. It violated Mr. Carrillo's confrontation rights. It's structural error. It affected the entire framework in which the trial proceeded. It caused trial counsel to be working under a conflict in that he has to cooperate with the attorney for one of the victims in the case.
Mr. Meyer, let me ask you about this case. Have you found any case on structural error that has addressed this type of situation?
No, and I have not, and I don't think you would expect to, because I think most reasonably competent trial counsel would catch this issue long before it ever got to this stage.
All right, and let me ask you a second question then. So you're asserting this is structural error and we don't have any precedent for that. But then what you are citing as some of the reasons why it would be structural error, you're citing to write to confront and cross-examine the minor in this case. And isn't that a trial error?
No, I think that, first of all, I have to respectfully disagree that we don't cite authority. If you look at the cases for structural error, I mean, really, no two cases are alike. The court set forth the definition of structural error, and I understand that's what the prosecution has argued, but you wouldn't expect other cases to be like that. The authority is the definition of what structural error is, that it affects the framework, and in this particular case, it goes far beyond just a trial error. This permeated the every part of the case, so I'm not sure. I don't think it's accurate to say there isn't authority for this. True, there are no other cases in which trial counsel lets his client stand trial with a victim, but when you read the definition of what structural error is, I think it fits squarely within the framework.
All right. So given that the framework of the trial has been adversely affected here. Let's talk about what are the things that you're addressing that has affected the framework of the trial. Because I guess in my previous question, I'm not so much seeing that a confrontation right violation is a framework issue, that's more a trial issue.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
Well, it affected the framework in terms of everything from sharing time on witnesses to cooperating with defense attorneys to the evidence applying to both charges, not just the charge of first-degree murder, but also the charge of contributing to the delinquency. I mean, so I'm not sure if I understand the question when you say it's a trial error versus a structural error.
All right.
Structural error that affected the trial.
Right, okay. But there's a distinction between structural errors, which affect the framework of the trial, and trial errors, which can be more evidentiary, ability to call witnesses, ability to confront witnesses, and those,
I see.
That's
right. I think it's both, obviously. Clearly it's a trial error, but it's also a structural error because it goes to the counsel for the for Mr. Carrillo and how he had to cooperate with the counsel for Mr. Montoya, and it isn't just an issue of evidence, it's an issue of actually sharing his trial strategy with the attorney for Mr. Montoya.
Didn't they essentially have the same trial strategy and the same position throughout the trial?
I'm sorry?
He and counsel representing Mr. Montoya basically had the same approach and defense.
Well, and that's one of the biggest problems here is they shouldn't have had the same approach.
And what would have been done differently in your view?
Mr. Cruz, trial counsel, should have presented a defense that, because there was evidence to support that Mr. Cruz had, that Mr. Montoya and Anthony Carrillo were the only two that knew about what Anthony Carrillo was going to do. That when those two left the other three, and as they were walking to the victim's home, they hatched this plan. And there should have been an adverse defense that was asserted by trial counsel. And instead of presenting an adverse defense, which was obvious and apparent, he cooperates with Mr. Montoya and his attorney and actually presents a defense which aligns David Carrillo with Mr. Montoya. Should have been to have distanced himself as far as he could from Mr. Montoya.
Did he effectively do that, though, by making the opening statement that essentially, if there's a plan here, it was a plan to break windows?
Well, that certainly was, no, I don't think he did effectively do it. I think he tried to do it, but the more obvious defense is that based on the testimony that we had from the interviews that they had with Mr. Anthony Carrillo, is that it was far more than that. As there was testimony about what they discussed as they were walking over there, testimony as when they left the group, what they talked about. So the evidence was far more, I think, than simply this idea to break windows.
But I mean, the evidence was admitted that you're talking about, correct?
Which evidence?
The evidence from Anthony Carrillo?
Anthony Carrillo was not called to testify.
Right, but didn't that come into the trial, into this trial? Didn't some of it get into evidence?
Some of Anthony Carrillo's statements to other defendants did come into evidence, you're right. And it's because that all came in that I don't think it's a reasonable defense to simply argue that they were going to break windows. I mean, that's there's too much of the testimony that came in from Anthony Carrillo to suggest it was far more than that. I don't think there was any question that Anthony Carrillo intended to shoot Mr. Romo. There's no question he intended to do that. So once you get over that hurdle, you better distance yourself from the two people who were there. The only two people were at this shooting. The first one is Anthony Carrillo, and the second one was Mr. Montoya. They're the only two that were present. And you better do whatever you can to get as far away from Mr. Montoya as you possibly can. But instead, he's actually the co-defendant in the case. And instead, Mr. Cruz, the trial counsel, is actually cooperating with him. I mean, it's such an obvious, in my opinion, such a gross irregularity that, and also I want to also note, it's very unique. I mean, I've asked every defense attorney I can find if they've ever heard of a similar situation. They never have. So it's unlikely we may never see it again. It's not going to open any sort of floodgates in terms of other defendants who are out there. It's a very highly unique situation, and I just think it's such a gross irregularity and so fundamentally unfair. And all of the, I mean, if nothing else, it certainly should have gotten a severance. If Mr. Cruz had simply argued, you know, Your Honor, you can't allow my client to stand trial with his victim in this case. Is there any doubt whatsoever that a trial judge would have in that situation granted the severance? I think he would have. I'll save my 3.5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, Paul Kaler, 19210, for the people here. I'm not going to defend first post-conviction counsel's work, the amount of work he did here, or the amount of supervision he did. Granted, there's lots of good paralegals and such in the world that do excellent work, and this one appears substantially more experienced than most. But obviously, Mr. Hartley should have supervised more, had more contact in the writing of this post-conviction motion. But that just pulls us back to our ineffective assistance of counsel claim, is what claims were omitted by this paralegal because he was not supervised that either Mr. Hartley would have done had he done all the work on this motion himself, or would another post-conviction attorney have done on this case. And I think the defendant presents several claims. I think we show through our brief that none of those claims meet the high standard to demonstrate ineffective assistance of counsel. I think too, and when we talk about,
I was just going to say, would you focus for a moment on the arguments made by counsel about the lack of severance and the claim of structural error and
connection? Sure, Your Honor. As you know, Your Honor, counsel does need to forecast changes in the law in order to be effective. It can try the case as this case was done in 1996, 1995, and can base the case on the law at that time. My research was, and I looked a lot, and I think counsel looked a lot of cases where two defendants like this being tried together was found to constitute structural error. There is no case on that. Trial counsel, and by extension, direct appeal counsel, and by extension, first post-conviction counsel, cannot be held responsible under an ineffectiveness claim for not presenting a claim that was unknown to law then and still unknown to law right now. It's just not a claim that any reasonably competent criminal defense attorney, either in 96 at the time of trial or any time since then, is required to know. Because of course,
Mr. Kaler, perhaps not frame it in the context of structural error. I agree with you that concept seems to have postdated the trial here. But the issue is, should counsel have raised the fact that he was being tried with his victim as additional grounds for severance? Because I don't think that was raised, was it?
No, that was not raised. Again, there's no case that says that counsel had to do that. Counsel presented a severance motion here on the mandatory ground for severance under both the statute and Crimpy 17 or 14, whichever it is, saying that material evidence would be presented against one, but not against the other, and the other person would be unfairly prejudiced by it. That's the mandatory ground. As far as any sort of inconsistent verdicts or the defendant being the so-called victim of his crime, that's not a ground for severance that I'm aware of. No court has ever done that. And I don't...
But have we ever seen any case that...
No, I don't think it's unusual. At least the underlying fact situation of gang members in trying to use juveniles to insulate themselves from liability, use them as their means of committing crimes, that's not an unusual situation. I as the court knows, I found one case from Louisiana where a father was prosecuted for this, but I don't know of any cases where it was done, but I don't think it's an unusual situation for senior gang members to be tried for contributing counts for involving junior members in a crime. And I think, really, the victim in this count was Mr. Romo, who was shot. There was no claim here that the juvenile was, you know, forced into thing. He was a full willing participant in Mr. Romo's murder. There was actually no reason for them not to be tried together.
Well, Mr. Kaler, let's just assume if he were a victim, could you address the arguments that your opposing counsel made about how this affects the framework of the trial from beginning to end? And he was giving examples such as how having to share strategies or peremptory challenges.
Well, I think you're wrong in your questions earlier, Your Honor. Framework is something much bigger than that. Framework has to do with a corrupt judge. Racially discriminatory jury panel, Batson claims, things like that. Something that is outside the trial, and inside the trial, things that happen inside the trial like this are matters of trial error that can or cannot be raised by counsel. And there was really no claim that that the victim status of the juvenile here prejudiced the defendant in any way, in any real way. Their defenses were not inconsistent. They both said that it was Tony Carrillo's, the brother's, decision to shoot. People claim that they didn't know about it until he actually started shooting. And the theory of defense by both defendants was fully consistent that they were there just to break windows. The prosecution presented other evidence, which the jury believed, that they were mad at him for busting, I guess is what the term they used in the record, that he left their gang and joined another gang, and he needed to be paid back, and that they went there to kill him. And the jury, as the finder of fact, was the part of this process that could make that decision, and there was more than sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict on all three counts. So yeah, they were not, I could see possibly, theoretically, if you were the victim, a criminal and a victim being tried together, I guess theoretically it's possible, but not on a contributing count.
Right, well, what concerns me on this issue in trying to analyze it is the structural problem, the theoretical conflict of the status of perpetrator-victim. Because I think that our conversation is going more toward, well, what actually happened here and were defenses antagonistic or not, which is more a factual question and not a status question, and does that matter?
Yeah, I think you were right, or at least the import of your questions earlier, Honor, that things that happen during the course of the trial are trial errors. They can be constitutional errors, trial errors. They could be non-constitutional trial errors. And to the extent that the defendant is raising a severance claim, that's more of a non-constitutional claim, as he's raising ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That too is not a structural error. It's a form of trial error, constitutional trial error, which can be examined and analyzed based on the facts presented to the post-conviction court and the facts that occurred during the course of the trial itself.
All right, so having to share peremptory challenges, or what about that?
I can't remember what the rules were back then concerning sharing challenges, but each defendant gets extra ones. I think there used to be a reduced number, but more than just dying by yourselves. Again, there's no claim. Well, we thought about, during the direct appeal, we thought about juror selection issues, and that's all done. That was settled by the Supreme Court, and we don't have any claim that there were any other biased jurors who actually decided the case. I don't know, it's it's not the building in which the trial occurred, and the building is the judge and the procedures used to select the jury. What happens inside the building, what happens in the trial, is trial error that can be analyzed. And there's absolutely no case that I could find where structural error has even been suggested as being possible in the situation, let alone at the time trial counsel, who was making the decisions in defending the defendant, what he was faced with and what he could be constitutionally required to be aware of. And I think that's what we do when we're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
Mr. Kaler, I think part of the argument is that even if it wasn't antagonistic between Montoya and Mr. Carrillo, it should have been. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm not sure we had in the post-conviction, well, there were a lot of claims raised in post-conviction. I don't think being presented here is a wrong theory of defense claim. I think that the theory of defense claim was that they were surprised by what Tony Carrillo did when he finally shot. That was a consistent defense. Even if they were able to devise some sort of antagonistic defense. I spent a lot of time looking, and I put down all the usual standards I have for what constitutes an antagonistic defense, irreconcilable, things like that. I could not find a case, in a simple case like this, where that was found to require a severance, where the usual procedures, what U.S. Supreme Court said in Zafiro, what this court has said concerning true antagonistic defenses, that does not require a severance. That other things, such as clear instructions to treat each defendant's case separately during their deliberations and to treat the evidence concerning each defendant separately, that clears up the problem. Court after court says committing a crime together is a perfectly reasonable and almost irrebuttable reason for trying two defendants together.
But here there is some distinction because Mr. Montoya and Anthony Carrillo were the only ones who were at the house, and David Carrillo, the defendant here, was a block away. So that it looks like a lot easier case to make out against Mr. Montoya. And I guess the argument is the opportunity would be there if there were separate trials for him to indicate that Mr. Montoya was under the influence of Anthony Carrillo and not of the defendant.
Well, sure, I'm not saying it's an unreasonable theory of defense. Certainly competent counsel could have presented that, but competent counsel could also have decided a united front between these two defendants to point the finger at the person who was not there on trial. That too was a reasonable theory of defense.
Even though the co-defendant is a victim under the delinquency.
Charge. You have to twist my arm to admit that he was a victim on that count. I think Chris Roma was the victim on that, Your Honor. He was not led into temptation. He was a voluntary member of this gang. This gang had done bad things before, as gangs do. Even in Pueblo, they do their purposes to commit bad things as a joint operation. He was not a victim. He was a willing member of this crime. There was no claim that he was coerced or forced into this. There was no claim that either the Carrillo brothers had forced him into committing this crime. He was a voluntary participant. So I understand the theory that he could be a victim of a contributing count, but I don't think it's such a theory that counsel has to say, I would rather be antagonistic to him than as opposed to joining forces with him and pointing the finger at a third party. I'll just address the lesser included offense instruction claim. I think the defendant could have asked for a lesser included offense instruction. If he changed his theory of defense and said the people that said that supported the accessory thing, throwing the gun into the lake. If he had changed his theory of defense, he could have gotten an instruction on that. But in order for them to prevail on this claim on ineffective assistance of counsel grounds, he's got to show that reasonable probability and a different result of the trial because he asked for and received a lesser-included offense instruction on accessory to commit murder. I don't think the defendant has proved that, has carried his burden on that, because you can always ask for more counts, and that just means you get a longer sentence, or more counts, the jury can find more counts against you. In order to prevail here, the defendant has to show that had his counsel requested this instruction, the jury would have been convicted him on that count only and acquitted him on all other the other three counts. I don't think the defendant has made a showing. I don't even sure how he could make a showing on that particular ground where the jury would make such a verdict. I think he fails on his burden as to that. I guess that's all I have. The court has any other questions about the other claims? I'll try to say something sensible about them.
Does the record show that trial counsel did explain complicity to the defendant?
No, there was no, actually, it was kind of, it was one of the funny things in the record I noticed, that nobody asked him directly, what did you tell him about that? But his letter, defendant's exhibit KK, which is in the record, clearly states the prosecution has evidence here from which it can convict you. He said this is a good deal. He urged him to take the deal. Under the ineffective assistance of counsel claims presented in our brief, that's all counsel needs to do. Counsel does not need to browbeat his clients into taking a deal. As we know from Bergeron and other cases, the decision whether to take a plea is key, is the defendant's personal decision to make. And defense counsel cannot browbeat or force or do anything to make the defendant take that. There's no requirement. I guess there's that old Adams case from the early 90s where the defendant's counsel used, I'll say, very blue language to explain to the defendant what would happen if he went to prison. And that was now not ineffective. But here, there's no requirement that counsel need do that. He presented the plea, he set forth the parameters, everything was accurate there. He said it was a good deal, and he said the prosecution has evidence from which it can convict you of this charge. David Carrillo made a bad choice not to accept that deal. He was foolish of him not to accept that, but that was his choice. It was his opportunity, his choice to make that bad decision many years ago, and he's stuck with that right now. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you. I agree David Carrillo had the right to make a choice, but he had the right to make a choice only after he was fully advised by his counsel. And the only way to make a fully informed decision is to understand complicity. I think the district court in this case recognized that, and the district court recognized that if complicity wasn't explained, it would be ineffective. And so the district court inferred that complicity had been explained to him. So that's the issue, is not whether David Carrillo has the right to make his own choice, but he has the constitutional right to be fully informed before he makes that decision for himself.
Well, Mr. Meyer, in the post-conviction transcript, it looks like Mr. Carrillo did testify, and he did say, I knew they were going on a complicity theory, and this is what complicity means to me. And so in light of that evidence, was it unreasonable for the court to then infer that complicity was explained to him?
Well, yeah, I think it was, because twofold. My recollection, I was at that hearing, but my recollection is he was explaining what complicity means to him now. He understands what complicity, I mean, I've explained it to him now, and he understands that he's read the briefs, not what he meant then. And even then, when you read what he says, if he does discuss, I thought what he testified to pretty clearly is that it was never explained to him, and he didn't understand it, even though he does have an understanding of it now. But I guess the transcript speaks for itself on that.
All right. Well, and his testimony included, had he understood that he could go down for complicity on first-degree murder, given that his brother pled guilty to second-degree murder?
And I think he said he didn't quite get that.
All right.
Isn't that what he said? He couldn't quite understand how, if his brother, who apparently he was complicit with, was convicted of second-degree murder, how can he be convicted of first-degree murder? And that was never explained to him by trial counsel. That's right. The opposing counsel here talks about this theory of Mr. Montoya being the victim. That's not my theory. That's the prosecution's theory. They're the ones that called Mr. Montoya a victim in opening statements. So it isn't my theory. The oftentimes in contributing to the victim of a minor, the minor might be a willing participant. That isn't the point. The point is he was clearly the victim as the prosecution describes him. Lastly, on the fundamental fair or on the structural error issue, I do think too the status of the parties is important on a structural error analysis. Here we have the status of perpetrator and victim both being tried as co-defendants, and I think that does amount to structural error. It certainly amounts to fundamental unfairness. Now, I'm not quite sure if fundamental unfairness and structural error are the same thing, but I do know that there's a lot of cases that discuss fundamental unfairness, and in those cases, they say automatic reversal is required, and I think this case certainly meets the definition of fundamental unfairness. And then last but not least, the issue of the lesser not included, opposing counsel, I think, misstates the standard for what prejudice is. You don't have to prove that he would have only been convicted of the lesser non-included. You simply have to show that there's a basis in the evidence. You don't have to show it with absolute, total certainty. I think I cite the standard in the brief, and it's far less than opposing counsel would suggest. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.